May it please the court, my name is Sean Paris, and I represent Gary Williams. Before I launch into the argument, I believe it's appropriate perhaps to sort of recap the procedural history of this case. Mr. Williams was charged in two separate cases, actually three. Those three cases ended up being joined later in the proceedings. They were severed. What's important to note is that the trial court made a distinction between commercial burglaries and those described in the case here, which are burglaries of newly constructed residences, nearly completed, but for which a certificate of occupancy had not yet issued. At the preliminary hearing stage in this case, the county court dismissed the second-degree burglary of a dwelling charge in 03 CR 281 on the basis that since no certificate of occupancy had issued for that particular building, it could not be considered a dwelling. And the court took a similar action with respect to 03 CR 336 by only binding over to the district court the lesser included charge of burglary of a building, not finding probable cause for burglary of a dwelling in that instance. The reason that's important is coupled with the trial court's ruling with respect to the 404B issues, it only admitted evidence in of other like burglaries of buildings nearing completion, not occupied, so that the jury only had in front of it evidence with respect to that sort of burglary and not any occupied structures or commercial burglaries that were part of the case in the broader sense, but for which no facts entered into the jury trial that the jury could consider.
Mr. Paris, if I can interrupt you here. I recognize a lot of your argument on the dwelling issue focuses on the certificate of occupancy piece. I guess I have two related questions. First, what law says there needs to be a certificate of occupancy? What law is there that says that that's the requirement? There is a statutory definition of dwelling that, among other things, talks about intend to be used for habitation. So that's question one. And then two, well, why don't you ask that first?
Okay, I'll come back. So I think what's important to note here is that the county court made a determination, made a ruling that as a matter of law, it was not a dwelling and bounded over. The people at that point had a couple of options. They could have appealed. They could have sought some review of the trial court's ruling on that, but they did not. And so to that extent, I think the law of the case doctrine would indicate that they're bound by that, period, throughout the case.
You anticipated exactly my next question, which was you don't actually recite law of the case in your brief, that name and a doctrine, but that was my understanding of what you were arguing. So you've now confirmed that for me.
Right. And I think, you know, in the opening and the reply brief, I didn't note the fact that that county court determination was never appealed.
Right, and I wasn't intending to criticize you, I understand. And I understood what, I was pretty sure I understood what you were arguing, but I wanted to make sure. So let's assume that this is law of the case. Isn't there a law that says when the trial court is taught, it's talking about a trial court ruling on its own prior ruling, it's not bound, it's discretionary, different than if the appellate court had ruled. So why in this case couldn't, when it got to trial, the second judge here say, I think the first judge got it wrong, which is kind of what happened.
Because looking at the record, there are no facts that are brought out to prove up that this was a burglary of a dwelling. In other words, all the 404B evidence underscores this theme. And in fact, if I can go on a segue real quick, the trial court made the 404B cutoff with respect to unoccupied buildings and excluding those with respect to commercial structures. So it was very clear that the only 404B evidence we're talking about at the trial court level was the unoccupied structures, not yet dwellings. So that's one. But two, there really is no evidence in the record to suggest that Mr. Williams intended to burgle a dwelling in this instance. And again, the narrow context in which we're talking about is whether he committed a conspiracy to commit a secondary burglary of a dwelling.
What's your definition? I'm sorry to interrupt you. What's your definition of dwelling? That's what I'm struggling with, because the statute says a building which is used, intended to be used, or usually used by a person of habitation. Here we have undisputed evidence. It was near completion. There were appliances in there. The COA was issued right after the burglary happened. Why isn't that a dwelling?
Because it's not lawfully an occupied structure until the certificate of occupancy issues. People can certainly dwell there, but it's not intended to be dwelled in until that certificate of occupancy issues. And so the question is, if, for example, a commercial developer who looks at a commercial warehouse and thinks to himself, I am going to convert this to a loft, at what point does it become a dwelling? Once he has a thought, once he does some substantial work towards that transformation, or at a more formal stage when he gets that certificate so he can now start inviting people to actually come in and dwell there. I think that is a very critical distinction. It's one that the county court picked up on, and it's one that should have remained throughout the case.
Well, if we were to consider the facts in this case, we don't have a commercial loft situation, but we do have a neighborhood that's being built and clearly houses that are intended to become dwellings. And so based on that and looking at the statute, what is meant by intended then?
Well, intended, in my review of the statute and the facts, these two cases, it implies something more than just having formulated an intent to construct a dwelling. And so when the first foundational stone is laid, does that transform it into a dwelling? Because work has started on something that is intended to become a dwelling. And surely it cannot be that early stage, or a burglary of a construction site for a residential neighborhood would always be burglary of a dwelling. And that, I don't think, is what the statutory definition talks about. In this case, I think it's undisputed that these were not occupied. One homeowner had started to move in some of her stuff towards, with an eye towards obtaining the certificate of occupancy. But none of those critical steps that homeowners take in occupying their dwelling had taken place here at all. And so in this case, I believe there's insufficient evidence that Mr. Williams entered into a conspiracy to commit burglary of a dwelling, when his MO very clearly established in all the 404B evidence, and of course the companion case that was joined to this one, indicates that he very specifically targeted houses nearing completion. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that somehow his intent changed to now very specifically go after a burglary of a dwelling with respect to the 876 Diamond Ridge Circle.
Counsel, do I hear you arguing that unless the building had been occupied, it's not a dwelling?
I think that's part of what I'm saying. I understand that there's friction with reconciling that with intended, or how it was intended to be used, because that does signal something short of actual occupation. But there has to at least be the legal capacity to occupy it as a dwelling and not merely squat into some building that was erected. If there are no other questions on this first argument, I would like to transition to the Roberts argument, if I could. I think this is this case presents a very novel application, perhaps, of Roberts, and that is the question of what exactly is the unit of prosecution for theft. I think we all thought we knew what that was when Roberts came out. It's anything within a six-month period gets consolidated into one charge of theft. But a lot of open-ended questions still remain, such as can this go into other, I'm not going to say jurisdictions, but other venues. Is there a requirement that there be some identity of victim with respect to all the consolidated theft charges? And I think the statute, looking at Roberts, recognizing that now Roberts is somewhat obsolete by legislative override, But looking at Roberts as it existed, or as it should have been applied in 2001, I should say, we have a situation where we have multiple thefts that did occur within a six-month period. I showed this to opposing counsel, this is a diagram that he presents in his answer brief, trying to come up with a formula to somehow put the March 2001 thefts from the Arapahoe County case in a different bracket, six-month bracket, from the ones in our case. But bottom line is that both of those cases occurred within 6 months. And so we don't have to go to defining brackets to try to somehow separate this. I think the logical extension of people's argument in this is that they could take a theft, two thefts separated by an hour, and somehow put them in different brackets because they belong to different six-month periods. And I think the case law is pretty clear that you don't do that. You only do that if you can somehow come up with different bracketing. And in that instance, of course, the appellate court or even the trial court should give as much weight to the jury's verdict as possible that produces the most number of convictions. But we don't quite have that here. The second argument with respect to the victim.
We go back to your first argument. Yes. I believe there was supplemental authority that had been submitted for oral argument on the Randell case. Did you receive the...
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'd have to look at that because the most recent authority that I cited in my brief was Lucero versus People. So I haven't had a chance to look at Randall.
Somebody also cited Vigil, and Randall, I can't remember, maybe both of you did. Randall kind of follows Vigil.
Vigil is the case, I think, that came out with trying to give as much weight to the jury verdict as possible by structuring brackets so that it yields the most amount of convictions.
Right, and the problem in Vigil where there are five thefts, and you can group them in different ways.
Right.
They get different six-month periods, which I think you're saying is not the case here.
It's not the case.
There's one six-month period.
Correct.
That's your argument.
From March to August is 6 months. The different victim issue, which I think the people relied on very much in the trial court in making their argument, was that since this case involves different victims, that Roberts doesn't apply. And I think that has since been answered by Lucero versus People, which I cited, which is a Roberts case where there are obviously different victims involved. Finally, with respect to the venue argument, it's clear that any theft committed within a six-month period can be considered as part of the same criminal episode, and therefore there really are no venue issues that are presented by this scenario. The third issue that I briefed for this court is perhaps the most stimulating one intellectually, and that is whether a person who has been found by a court to be a habitual criminal thereby loses his right to have the people prove up his habitual criminal status again in a subsequent prosecution.
Mr. Paris, if you let me interrupt you, I know your time is really limited. I've got a couple of really targeted questions. You have argued at length about the doctrine of offensive collateral estoppel or issue preclusion. Yeah, by all means. I guess I don't understand how this really is if issue preclusion of any kind, because if the court applied that, the court wouldn't have let you respond at all. The court said you can rebut. So that's my first question. And it seems to me really the court was kind of incorporating by reference the prior hearing and respond if you disagree, and said you can respond if you'd like. And Mr. Williams did have the witnesses on the way and said tell them not to bother.
Well, there was that right to respond. And Mr. Williams, if you want to challenge any of this evidence, you can. You can call your own witnesses. I think that was sort of the tenor of that hearing. But Mr. Williams has a right to have this proven up and to hold the people to the burden of actually producing evidence.
But what's wrong with the court saying, we're all the same people, they're about to put on the identical case I just heard, why don't we assume they did that for purposes here, and you can respond anew, even though you lost the last time? What's wrong with that procedure?
A couple of answers to that. One is that habitual criminal proceedings are in derogation of the common law, and therefore the statutory scheme is going to be strictly construed in the benefit for the benefit of the defendant. That didn't happen here. This is maybe a very imprecise analogy. This is no different than telling someone, we're pretty much convinced that you ran a red light, and now tell us why you didn't. I understand it's not the same, but he has the right to hear someone say, and the people and the person in this criminal record that suffered this conviction is the same person who's sitting right there, because I took his fingerprints and I took I took the fingerprints from the DLC pen pack, I compared them, same people. That never happened here. There's no finding on the record that Mr. Williams, who was sitting in that courtroom on the day of that sentencing hearing, is the same person in the pen pack. Now, this is unusual because...
Mr. Harris, it's okay. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Crane, attorney registration 37842. I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. Turning first, if the court would like, to the sufficiency of the evidence question, I think what we're looking at is, this is a sufficiency question. Did the jury have enough evidence upon which it could reasonably infer that the defendant, the facts as he knew them, allowed him to agree and have intent to commit burglary of a structure that at the time was intended to be used as a dwelling. The criminal statute's definition of dwelling, and I recognize it is defined by a criminal statute, as this court has already noted, is a building intended to be used by a person for habitation. That's the relevant definition of a dwelling for this case. The only point on which the defendant argues that he could not have had sufficient mental understanding or knowledge or belief of the facts to agree and thereby commit a conspiracy to commit burglary of a dwelling is that there wasn't a certificate of occupancy issued at the time. But the definition of dwelling under the criminal statute doesn't say anything about a certificate of occupancy. That might be, at most, a fact for the jury to consider, a factor. But what the jury had in this case was certainly sufficient to allow it to infer many rational inferences that the defendant was committing an agreement with an intent to promote burglary of a dwelling.
Mr. Grant, let me ask you, where would the line be here? I'm just picking up on Mr. Parris's argument.
Sure.
What if the foundation is in, period? Is that a dwelling? I mean, at what point is it a dwelling?
Those are great hypotheticals, and I really think they were good hypotheticals, and they point out where the gray areas are in this question. We don't face those gray areas in this case. I mean, what we have in this case is a fully completed house, as you pointed out, to the point that major appliances were installed. Electricity was apparently running. Water was running. I mean, anyone could have lived at this in this house at the time. And really, the defendant had no reason to believe there weren't people living in this house. And he took upon himself the danger that there could have been people or a person living in this house. As far as I know, he didn't check the county records and see that a certificate of occupancy hadn't issued. I don't think we had any evidence that he made those checks, et cetera. I understand the modus operandi argument that he, probably didn't believe. But what we're looking at is, did the jury have enough evidence to believe that he did believe the facts to be that this was an agreement to burglarize something intended to be used as a dwelling?
So what was the evidence before the jury? Because I understand that your opposing counsel has characterized it, that the evidence was that defendant was targeting nearly completed homes and deliberately trying to target homes that had not been lived in. So what evidence was presented for the jury that would show that someone could have been living there?
Well, there was no evidence that people were living there. What I'm saying is he took the risk. He knew that this house was essentially a completed home to the point where he even showed up with a truck big enough to unload the appliances. I'm not saying he had any reason to believe or not believe that people were actually living there at the time. I don't think that was necessary for the jury to have sufficient evidence to reach its verdict on this point.
So your point there is that there would not need to be evidence of actual occupancy?
No, absolutely not. Intended to be used, it would be the applicable standard here. With respect to the Roberts issue, I don't see this as distinguishable from V. Hill or Randell, because I think this allows the court to view these and break up these thefts in a manner that maximizes a jury verdict and allows the unit of prosecution to be formed in that way.
But how do we get there, Mr. Crane? And I think Mr. Parris's hypothetical was a good one. I actually thought of in my own head was, what if you have thefts on consecutive days and that's it? It seems like, and I recognize you didn't write the brief in for the government in your case, but you know, could you just say, well, I could call it 6 months ending on July 15th and a new 6 months starting on July 16th? That seems like, no offense, but an absurd construction here, when V. Hill itself said the easy case is when you got them both within 6 months.
Right.
V. Hill dealt with, and I was on that division, as I'm sure you know, was over, you know, you could have five thefts, you can group them in a number of different ways. So, I mean, could you address that?
Well, I think the various thefts that defendant has raised in this case would allow them to be grouped in different ways, if I understand it correctly. V. Hill, as you pointed out, made the point that the easy cases are, they're all within 6 months, for example, they're all within 2 hours or 2 days. There's only one way to do it. It's within 6 months. It's one unit of prosecution. If they're spread out in a way that you can only group them in two separate units of prosecution, two separate six-month periods, that's easy too. That's how I understand V. Hill to read. But when there are thefts separated in ways where you could group them in different ways, that's when you've got the difficult question, and that's when V. Hill and Randell say you maximize the jury's verdict, you maximize the unit of prosecution, and allow the six-month periods to be constructed in a way that allows multiple thefts, the most number of thefts, to be grouped.
Well, forgive me, maybe I'm just not understanding. I thought we're just dealing with the Arapahoe County thefts that occurred on this date and the one theft which occurred on within 6 months of that date. Aren't we just dealing with those two?
Well, his argument, as I understand it, is a double jeopardy argument, and so he's raising some thefts in another county and saying, well, those were within 6 months of one of the thefts that I was prosecuted for here, and so I shouldn't have been able to be prosecuted for these because these were part of the unit of prosecution addressed in that prior case.
So I got the question is, why is that wrong? I mean, you've got those are the only two thefts we're talking about.
Well, his argument, your point is, I guess I'm arguing that V. Hill would apply in the same manner here. I understand they could be grouped, but here we're looking at several different thefts that were in different counties. And given the way they could have been prosecuted all in various ways in different counties or even in the same county under the venue and joinder rules, I believe, the way in which this is a permissible way in which the unit of prosecution should be constructed given these various thefts that occurred within this two-year period or whatever it was. And I guess I'll turn last then to, if the court has no further questions on that, or feel free to jump in. But the question of the habitual criminal proceeding, no question, this is an interesting issue, and I had never seen it before. Obviously, Colorado courts have not dealt with it before. I guess our position is, this can be addressed under collateral estoppel, and I don't believe there's a reason not to apply it here. Even if not, the remedy here is to remand for an actual habitual criminal proceeding and hearing, at which point the prosecution would put on evidence, and the defendant would again have the chance to dispute that evidence.
So if I can ask the same question to ask Mr. Parris, Mr. Yes. Crane, how is this collateral estoppel? Because the collateral estoppel doctrine would have said you're barred from challenging it again. And here I don't think there's any dispute. The courts, and from your perspective, you want to tell us He had the full chance to respond. So that wouldn't happen if the court barred this on collateral estoppel or res judicata, which you had raised below. I have a little bit of concern here because it seems like the folks below weren't exactly sure what doctrine they were talking about, including, with all due respect, the trial judge seemed to be unsure about it. So I don't understand the collateral estoppel argument when they were given a chance to respond. That, by definition, doesn't seem to me to be collateral estoppel.
And I agree that the parties below appeared to leave that for this court to decide or determine or figure out. But the reason that he needed to be given a chance to respond, the reason that's not within the normal collateral estoppel doctrine, that opportunity needed to exist in this case because for concerns of due process, basically, these prior convictions had been fully and fairly litigated, necessarily determined at a prior hearing, but they were not, they could have been undone by a collateral attack. That's what the parties mentioned here as the relevant example. Things could have changed since then, and if one of those convictions had been undone, a defendant in a criminal proceeding should certainly, as a matter of due process and fundamental fairness, have the opportunity to say, wait a minute, we had that proceeding, but this has changed. Things have changed since then. That's why that opportunity was given. But I don't think there was a reason otherwise to preclude the court from proceeding in this fashion. All the elements of collateral estoppel were addressed or were met in this case. The defendant had the opportunity to contest all of these charges before. And in this case, as you noted, even the same trial judge was presiding here and kind of pointed that out. So,
if any examples or any other cases you can cite to where collateral estoppel has been used against a defendant to preclude his ability to have a hearing anew on an issue?
The only thing that I found that might be of help was a law review article. And I didn't submit it as a supplemental authority. I didn't cite it to defense counsel, but if you would like, I'll cite the article. Basically, there's a few federal cases going both directions on this question, and some cases in which federal courts have found it appropriate to not allow a defendant to re-litigate a particular claim. A lot of them have to do with immigration status, but I haven't read all the cases.
Sorry, but you have no authority in Colorado that is?
No, Your Honor.
Asking Mr. Cran, just playing, I guess, devil's advocate a little bit, sure, fleshing out all the options. The court seemed, at least at some point, to think she was taking judicial notice of the prior proceedings. And as I indicated to Mr. Parrison, trying to figure this out myself, it seemed like the court effectively was saying, I'm going to assume you presented the exact same evidence again. I'm going to assume you made a prima facie case. Now, if you want to respond, Mr. Williams, by all means, have at it. That seemed to be what the court was doing. So I'd ask you to react to that, if that's even a plausible reading of what happened.
I think it is plausible, but given the somewhat ambiguous language, it's hard to say exactly what the court was saying that it was doing. But my understanding was the prosecution was essentially saying, here are the two options, Judge. Here are our arguments. We think, first of all, this is precluded under, and prosecutor used language like res judicata, judicial notice, et cetera. I think really the only applicable doctrine there, the proper one under which this could fit, is collateral estoppel.
Actually, I think they did specifically use res judicata, if I remember. I think their motion was titled res judicata.
I agree.
They gave the hearing based on res judicata.
I agree. And at one point, I think the prosecutor also said claim preclusion. So these terms were all kind of thrown around a little bit loosely. So I think the prosecution essentially said, here's a theory on which we think we can proceed and don't need to present any evidence. As a matter of due process, if one of these priors has been overturned on collateral attack, defendant should have the opportunity to let us know and show that. Second of all, Judge, if you're not willing to adopt that theory, we've got our witnesses here and we're ready to go. We'll put on the evidence. And trial court essentially said, I'll go with option one. I'm going to rule this has already been done. In fact, I was the judge who was there. We've all done this before. Let's not do it again. Defendant, if you have anything, let us know. And he said, well, no, I wanted to do what my lawyer did. I wanted to do something different than the way my lawyer attacked those priors at the prior habitual proceeding. That's essentially what he said. And the court said, well, I'm not looking at, if you don't have something that's changed with respect to those priors, they've already been established. And he chose not to go forward and redo the same thing over those same priors, which the court offered him the chance to do.
I don't remember the court putting any limit on what he could do. Is that your memory? Is the court limited something? I thought...
No, the court really would have allowed him, it appears, to have have gone through the same prior hearing again without the people having it initially had to have put on the initial proof. It would have allowed him to do the cross-examination he thought his lawyer should have done at the
point. And correct me if I'm wrong on the record, but I think one witness was already there,
yes,
and one was coming and on the way, and then there was a break, and then Mr. Williams, who was representing himself, said, you know, tell him they don't need to bother. I'm going to stand on my objection to the procedure, I think is what happened.
Yes.
True?
Okay. Yeah, and so we never actually got to the point of wondering, well, what would have happened if the prosecution hadn't actually presented any proof, but he had presented this cross-examination that would probably present, you know, another interesting twist in this case. What we ultimately ended up with was a finding that this was already established at a prior hearing. I was the judge. We all did this. If you want, you can challenge and let us know what challenges you might have to any of this, to these priors, or the prior adjudication, and him saying, no, I don't have anything. I just think this isn't fair, or I just think the prosecution needs to put on proof at this actual hearing or this opportunity for a hearing. So, if the court has no further questions, I will thank the court for its time. Ask that the convictions be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel, both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.